to live righteously. It's time for another episode of the Cultural Hall. It's episode number 324, where we are going to talk with Darren Perry. Who is he? Well, he is the chairman of the Northwestern Band of the Shoshone Nation. He also serves on the board of directors for the American West Heritage Center, the Utah State Museum Board, and he serves on the advisory board of the Huntsman Cancer Institute. In 2017, he received the Esto Perpetua, help me out.
Perpetua
Award from the state of Idaho for one who preserved and promoted history in the state of Idaho. He is the first Utahn to win this award. He attended the University of Utah, Weber State, and got a bachelor's degree in secondary education with an emphasis in history. His passions in his life are his family, which includes his tribal family, which I love and is a message in some things that I listen to in anticipation of your episode. I love the idea of tribal family as well. Darren wants to make sure that the story of the Bear River Massacre and the outcomes of that horrific event are always remembered. He says it's important that the Shoshone perspective is heard, and he is a sixth-generation Shoshone Latter-day Saint. Thanks for being here, Darren.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So you are the chairman of the Northwestern Band of the Shoshone Nation. That is a big title. What does that mean?
What it means, I do a lot of elementary schools and share our culture, and when mostly fourth grade, because in Utah, that's the time they learn about the Native Americans in their area. So chairman means nothing to them. So what I tell them, I'm really the chief. I'm the modern day chief. So I'm responsible to make sure our tribe runs smoothly. I'm also responsible for making sure our history is not forgotten. So I do a lot of speaking as well.
Who are the Shoshone people?
Well, great question. The Shoshone Nation at one point was one of the largest Native American groups in the country. They took up from Colorado, Idaho, Utah, Nevada into California. Large nation of natives. They broke off into smaller groups in the mid-19th century because it was easier to sustain life as smaller groups and clans and families. And so our group, the Northwestern Band, ended up in northern Utah, southern Idaho. And so from there...
So that's what, modern day, like Logan, or is it...
Modern day, our southern border would be the Salt Lake Valley.
Okay.
Our northern border would be up into the Pocatello, Idaho area, okay, where the Snake River goes. Our boundary actually goes into Nevada from there and a little bit into Wyoming and Colorado.
Huh.
So when you lived a hunter-gathering lifestyle, it was important that you had a wide range that you could forage at certain times of the year to gather seeds, berries, nuts. When the game was plentiful, you were in certain areas. When the salmon were in the river, you were up north in the Snake River. So It was just important that you had a wide range. We always called, though, the Cache Valley near Logan home. That would be our home base.
Mm-hmm.
But from there, we foraged all over.
There is a lot of, maybe it's weight. I don't know if that's the exact word I want to put on it. But when we talk about, and even the terminology, so you're going to help me here. Is it still okay in this day and age to say Native American, or is it indigenous people? Is that more preferred, or what's...
It depends who you talk to.
Okay.
I even refer to ourselves as Indian.
Okay.
Even though there may be a group or two that call themselves Native Americans that might be offended with that.
Okay.
Every group is a little different. So you just kind of, whoever you're talking to, you just sometimes to acknowledge, you know, what would you prefer is best. We call ourselves Native American Indians. I mean, we go with pretty much anything.
So for the purposes of this, you would like to be referred to as
Native Americans, okay, is fine.
Perfect. So when we talk about Native Americans, I mean, beginning with that, but there is a lot to unpack because of such a rich and beautiful history, but also kind of dark and tragic history as well. Talk about that.
Yeah, it's really a story, and And it's a story we don't often hear in our history books today. If you think about Native Americans, when they taught their children history, they were taught by tribal elders. The children sat at their feet and told them stories about their people, and that's how we disseminated knowledge. And so if you're a normal person that goes to school, you don't get those stories. You don't get the stories that we share. And it's a beautiful culture. We were here. We thrived. We lived as families. We got along for the most part. We fought other tribes and every now and then. But for the most part, we were a thriving community. We weren't savages. And we lived as family units, and the family unit was sacred. And Mother Earth was sacred. We had a stewardship over Mother Earth. A lot of people think, well, the natives believe they own the land. Mm-hmm. We've never believed we own the land, but we had a stewardship over that land. And so as colonization came to our borders and then came further west, especially with the Transcontinental Railroad, it brought change. Mm-hmm. And so that hunter-gatherer lifestyle, or the plains lifestyle of making sure the buffalo was always around so they could live, because they used every part of that buffalo for food, clothing, and shelter.
Right.
It just changed their way of life. They knew no other way. And so, you know, colonization, those immigrants knew farming practices. They were agriculturists. They had cattle. They had other things. And that's how they lived. We didn't have those skill sets. And so when you introduce a new group of people that come in and actually, you know, their manifest destiny to take over this land and to push us to places that we weren't really used to going.
Right.
And in a lot of cases, just outright killing the Native Americans, then it's a dark history. But it's not one, if you know anything about me, I don't dwell on those things that happened in the past, those terrible things. I suppose we could, and there are a lot of Native Americans today that do.
Right.
There's a lot of my friends that are loud and angry still.
Yeah.
And I just find that counterproductive. I just think, you know what, let's acknowledge what happened in the past, because we really, by acknowledging it, we can learn from it in the future. But it doesn't mean we need to stay there. Let's acknowledge it, and then let's move forward. And the most important message is, who are we today, and how can we become something greater? And so that's my message, is let's acknowledge it, let's move past it, and then let's see what we can do together to extend a hand of friendship to all groups. I mean, obviously, there's a lot of groups in our world today that are marginalized.
Yeah.
And so we happen to be one in the 19th century, and in some cases still are. But what can we do today to help everyone?
I love that attitude. And so maybe that can guide us as we have this discussion. There may be some things that we're going to share within this episode that, could in fact be disturbing, right? And so I just want to give that kind of heads up to people as we kind of delve into this. I think the first thing is the acknowledgement. So I want to talk about the Bear River Massacre. I want to talk about what that is, tell people.
Okay.
Now, the challenge is going to be for you, Darren, is I try and keep these at about an hour. So we, in the full scope, we have to just make sure, because I've listened to you speak on it a couple of times online, and I love it. It's such a rich story, and I'll leave those links in association with this episode, so if people want to know more about it. But I feel like we can do a pretty good job of at least acknowledging what the Bear River Massacre was in the time that we have, and subsequently what we can learn from it.
Sure. And let me lay some groundwork before we talk about the massacre. I mean, our people were here in the Salt Lake Valley in July when Brigham Young and the first group of pioneers got here.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, our chief Sagwitch took a group of men, and it's been documented in church history that he met with Brigham Young and that first group of pioneers 2 days after their arrival into the Salt Lake Valley. Now, I'm sure he had a couple of things in mind.
Yeah.
He had known the white man throughout his lifetime, because of the trappers and mountain men. I'm sure he was curious, or what's your intentions? Are you going to stay? The other thing is, he was probably, if you're going to stay, we have had a stewardship over this land, and it's been carefully taken care of. And so what are your intentions with that? And how can we maybe coexist? And so history tells us that the Mormon pioneers from that first encounter and Sagwitch and his band got along pretty well. I mean, you know, they did as good as they could to stay out of each other's way. I know the Shoshones showed those pioneers some of the local plants that they could harvest to eat, some of the plants that were used as certain medicines. You know, so that relationship started out generally good. There was a skirmish here and there, but for the most part, it was okay. As more and more saints arrived to the valley, though, good land was becoming scarce, and Brigham Young began sending out scouts. And what he did in 1855 is he sent a group of men to the Cache Valley, which is about 60 miles north of Salt Lake City, on the other side of the mountain range. If you've ever been there, it's beautiful. Mm-hmm. It sits in the middle of a bunch of mountains, and there's rivers and streams and lakes and wild grass and just a beautiful high mountain valley that was different from the Salt Lake Valley completely. Once the Mormons discovered the Cache Valley, that changed things. That was kind of our home base. We could have lived there forever because of the natural resources that were there.
Right.
The fish and game and other things that we hunted. So once the pioneers discovered that valley, more and more saints began arriving to that valley. The church actually in that first year took up 4,000 head of cattle through that valley because of the rich grasses. But what that did is now, instead of being able to walk and harvest as normal, the pioneers were hunting the same deer and elk and antelope and moose. Mm-hmm. They were putting up fences. Their cattle were eating those grasses and seeds that the Shoshone had relied on for centuries. And so now you have a depletion of resources and two groups of people living two different lifestyles. One was agricultural, one was a hunter-gatherer. And so as those resources began to be depleted, there was tension.
Sure, because it's essentially, you know, someone's going to eat and it's going to be me or you, or someone's going to have a place to live and it's going to be me or you. Maybe not that barbaric or black and white, but I mean, at the end of the day, that's what it becomes.
That's what it becomes. And here's the key to all this. Native Americans never had a belief in personal property. So keep that in mind as you think about this. So if there was a family in need within the tribal family, everyone worked together to make sure that need was taken care of. It was never a personal property thing. And so if you can imagine yourself, if you're a Shoshone man with a family and your neighbors in Franklin, Idaho, which wasn't Idaho then, but Franklin, one of the pioneer towns, a man and his family had three cattle out in the field and your family's starving, what are you going to do? And they felt like they could share. And so there were definitely Indian depredations that were taking place. Mm-hmm. Because of the just nature of the resources being depleted. And so I tell people, our people had three options: beg for food, which they did, starve, and they did that too, or steal. And the funny thing about that is my grandmother said, Darren, our people never stole anything. They were always collecting rent. And so she truly believed that, though. So, you know, I laugh about it today because we all know better.
Right.
But, you know, you have two different people with two different ways of thinking. So something's bad's about to happen.
So this sort of sets the groundwork then for what we now deem the Bear River Massacre.
Yes, it does. In fact, that's why you needed that context to see really where, you know, they'd gotten to from 1847 to 1855 and the introduction of colonization in the Cache Valley. And now we're getting to 1862 and 1863. There were, not only did you have the Mormon pioneers, but you had the California and Oregon Trail. that cut through that area. And so now, as gold was discovered in California, you have massive amounts of people migrating to the West Coast that were cutting through this area as well. So you just have so many chances for interaction. And in the early days, the pioneers described Sagwitch and his band as the friendly ones. As more and more saints arrived, they began to describe us as thieves and beggars. Now, that statement, they are the friendly ones, means that there were other Native American groups growing through that area as well. I know the Blackfeet, and Chief Pocatello was a Northwestern Shoshone, but he had his own group of people who resided more in southern Idaho. They were not as tolerant of the immigrants that were coming through. So there were problems. There were some of those immigrant trains were attacked. Letters started to be written from the saints in Cache Valley and those using the California and Oregon trails. They made their way to Salt Lake, and they made their way to a federal judge in Salt Lake who, at the end of the day, issued arrest warrants for Chiefs Bear Hunter, Pocatello, and Sagwitch. There was nobody really to serve those arrest warrants. The only law enforcement in place was stationed just up the hill from the temple at Camp Douglas.
Okay.
It was the Army fort. Ironically, the Army is in Salt Lake. These guys were California volunteers. They signed up to fight in the Civil War halfway across Nevada on their way to the Civil War to fight. They get new orders that says, well, we're afraid from the government. We're afraid the Mormons might succeed from the Union. And so we need you to go to Salt Lake, establish a camp, and keep an eye on the Mormons. And not only that, protect the overland mail route. So that's their new orders. They get to Salt Lake. They don't like the LDS people at all. And that is shared
just
back.
because of different lifestyles, or because they feel the threat from the east or the west, people encroaching in their space.
Yes, and they were on their way to fight for the Union, and so they looked at, and the government didn't trust the Mormons were going to be on their side. It's like, hey, these guys might be traitors, and so we've got to keep an eye on them to make sure that they don't join the Southern Force or the Mexicans.
Right.
In their issues. So they ended up at Camp Douglas bored and just, you know, not what they signed up for. They signed up to fight and they weren't fighting. So when those arrest warrants came through and made their way up to Colonel Connor, Patrick Connor at Camp Douglas, he looked at this as an opportunity. And so that's really what started. He actually did an interview with the Salt Lake Tribune before he left Salt Lake. And he said, I have these arrest warrants for the chiefs, but I'm not going to arrest anyone. I'm going to take care of the Indian problem once and for all. Wow. So he knew exactly what he had in mind before he left camp and before he left Camp Douglas.
Well, let's take a break real quick right here. Okay. And let's come back and pick it right up with the Army leaving Salt Lake and headed north. We'll come back and do that in the second block of the Cultural Hall. I want to take a quick second and talk to you about Best DJ in Utah now in its second year. Last year, I went to Washington, to Roche Harbor, and did a gorgeous wedding. This year, I'm slated to go to Moab, to go to Denver to do weddings. And guys, it couldn't be going any better. Thanks in large part to folks like yourself, people who are listening to this and say, you know what, I need a wedding or a mobile DJ for something, and then reach out to me. You can go to bestdjinutah.com. You can find me on all of the social medias at Richie T. Stedman, or you can certainly just send me an email, Richie, R-I-C-H-I-E-T as in tough guy, Stedman, S-T-E-A-D-M-A-N @gmail.com. I would love to see what I could do to make your event that much better. Whether it's a party or the biggest day of your life, you need the best DJ in Utah. And like I said, it doesn't have to be in Utah. It can just be the best DJ in Utah. I don't know. Now we start to get into like the technical things. It's bestdjinutah.com.
Hi friends, Dan the Laptop Man here from PC Laptops. You know, I get a lot of emails with questions from customers, and here's one. Dear Dan, I love to do business at your stores, but I have a lot of Apple and PC stuff. It's too bad because I like doing business with local people. I wish there was a way to make all of my gadgets work together. Signed, Scattered. Dear Scattered, Windows, Mac, Android, we can make all of them sync up for you. Your phone, tablet, and PC. They'll all be one big, happy, diverse family. So Scattered, bring in all your Apple and PC stuff. Now that's comfort and peace of mind. Get a brand new PC laptop's desktop for just $799 with a lifetime parts and labor warranty at any PC laptop's location while supplies last. $799, you can't beat that deal. Please visit any one of our locations right now or call us at 1-877-596-SAVE or check us out at PCLaptops.com.
Time for the second block of the Cultural Hall. Take a second and wherever you're getting this show available in podcast form and leave us a review. If you do it on iTunes or you do it on Google Play or whatever the format is for you, take a second, leave us a review, or if you don't want to leave a review, tell a friend about the Cultural Hall. We're working really hard to do those two episodes a week, one on Monday and one on Friday. Interesting things like this story and also those articles of news that we share to keep you the latest and up to date for the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints news. Darren, the military is leaving Salt Lake. Let's pick it up.
Yeah, they're leaving Salt Lake, and they leave in the cover of darkness so that Native American scouts that were in the area would not know. But Sagwitch and his people knew they were coming. They had a friend that lived in Franklin who owned the grocery store in Franklin, a white settler that had was very good friends with Sagwitch and his people, and he said, hey, the Saints of Cache Valley and the others using the Oregon Trail are making plans to completely get rid of you guys, and the army is on their way. And so it wasn't like Sagwitch didn't know that those men were coming. They did. Mm-hmm. So, but they left at night. It was hard. It was below zero temperatures.
Ugh.
That January was really tough. They stopped in Brigham City and camped there overnight. They made that journey in a couple of days. And more than 250 cavalry on horses. They were taking cannons. Cannons got bogged down right outside of the massacre site, so they never did make it. The army didn't really know where the Indians were located, so they hired a guide, so to speak. And in the Mormon culture, we know who he is. His name was Porter Rockwell.
Oh, wow.
So Porter Rockwell plays a part in this, in as much as he guides the troops north to the Shoshone encampment. Hmm. We don't have any record or anything where he participated at all. And I don't believe he did. I just think he was hired for $5 to take the men, the army, to where they needed to go. Once he found the encampment, I think he probably watched, because that's the kind of guy he was anyway.
Yeah.
And before he left to go back to Salt Lake City. Hmm. So go to the January 27th, two nights before the massacre, we have an old medicine man by the name of Tindup. Tindup awakes in the middle of the night and he had a dream. And in his dream, he saw his people being killed by pony soldiers. That's how he explains it.
Interesting.
And so he wakes everyone up, tells everyone about his dream and urges everyone to leave camp that night. There were a few families that believed Tindup and they left with him. There were probably 30 people total that left with Tindup and his family. It's not that Bear Hunter and Sagwitch didn't believe him. They did. But they had had interaction with the army over the last 5 years. And they'd always been able to negotiate a peaceful settlement, a parley, so to speak.
Right.
So that was in their mind. We're not going to move 600 Shoshone in the middle of the night when we know, you know, the army will come, they'll parade around as they usually do to intimidate. We'll have a talk, and if there's any guilty parties that need to go, we'll give them up. But we feel like we're okay still. And so that was the setting. On the morning of January 29th, Sagwitch got up as normal. He got up early before anyone else, stepped outside of his teepee and surveyed the area. To the southeast, there's a bluff. And it looked like there was a steaming cloud or a mist on the edge of the bluff. And he really didn't realize what was happening. And then that mist appeared to lower along the bluff. And then he realized what was happening. The troops from Camp Douglas had arrived. And what it was they had been going all night. The horses were really lathered up and sweaty. And it was below zero. And the steam from the horses, and every time the horse would take a breath, walking in that deep snow, it would just create this steam cloud. And if you can imagine 250 horses coming down a bluff, that's what it looked like. So Sagwitch woke everyone up, said, just prepare yourselves. We're not sure what's going to happen. And as the army got closer, they began to ford the river at the lowest point there and began to fire upon Sagwitch and his people. And so there was no parley. There was no negotiation at all. They just started shooting.
Not even an attempt for conversation.
Not even an attempt. And that was never on their minds. There were 21 army that died. 17 were killed in that first charge across the river. They did a frontal assault. The Shoshone, a few of them had guns, not very many, and I'm sure they had very few bullets that they traded for, mostly bows and arrows and sticks and spears and crude weapons of war to fight with. But I think almost all of what they had to expend was expended in that first 10 minutes.
Wow.
And so almost all of the army's casualties happened in that first, you know, couple of minutes of the encounter. And from there, the army actually pulled back, regrouped, and then they decided to come in at different sides, come in from around the back, and force the natives down to the river, force them where there would be a natural boundary that they couldn't run to. So that's what happened. And what turned into a battle after maybe 10 minutes turned into a wholesale slaughter. Men, women, and children, my grandmother said, were being butchered like rabbits. And she said no butcher could have murdered any better. And we believe, and history is different on this, and there's a few accounts of how many perished, but the army account was about 245 in his report, Connor's report to the army in Washington, D.C. He actually put 245, and then in parentheses behind it, he put bucks, which means he counted the men only. And so there were two pioneer men from Franklin, Mormon settlers, that went through the next day. And as they walked through, they counted on the first count 469. And as they came back through, they counted 480. And so we believe the number, just because the number of lodges, it'll never be known. But we believe because of the amount of lodges that we knew were there and how many people usually were in each lodge, it was between 400 and 450. And the pioneers that went through later said the bodies were 10 deep in some places. And so, and these were men, women, and children. They didn't discriminate. His comment before he left that nits make lice meant that he was going to make sure the children didn't have a chance to grow up to adulthood. He was going to take care of all of it. So
just absolutely barbaric.
Absolutely. And think it was the largest massacre of Native Americans in the history of the U.S., especially west of the Mississippi. And it's a massacre that nobody knows about. And I talked to, I do a little, quite a few firesides for the church. And I was in Cache Valley one time and an old woman came up to me and I told the story of the massacre. And after she thanked me, but she said, we were told never to talk about it. And so I'm not sure, you know, guilt or remorse from the pioneers in that area had a factor in that. You just don't know, but you know, I know the local sentiments from those that after the massacre, some of those started coming out, and a lot of the sentiments from the locals that were in Wellsville and Logan were saying, you know, they got what was deserved. We tried to teach them the right way, but they refused to learn. And so I think Henry Ballard, a bishop of the Logan Second Ward, said, this put a quietus on them, and the Lord punished them without us having to do it. So you know, I think the local sentiment was, well, it's gone. I want to believe, though, that I don't think they had a wholesale massacre in mind when they wanted the problem to go away.
Right.
I'm going to give those locals the benefit of the doubt, saying, you know, they probably wanted us moved. Just round them up and move them somewhere out of our hair. So they're not here anymore.
So we're not competing for resources. So we don't have the, you know, the often difficult conversations. If we can just remove this problem, we don't want them dead, is the assumption you're
that's
making.
That's what I'm trying to get to. I think they were decent people, and they were horrified at the end of the day after they'd seen what had happened. But I'll just give them, cut them a little slack to say, and treaties were being signed all over the country at that time anyway. Native Americans were being relocated around this country to the worst land possible. So I'm just going to go with, that's what I think they wanted it to happen. But that's not what happened.
I would like you to, in the telling of the Bear River Massacre, I have heard the story of a young, like a baby that was placed near her mother that had been killed.
Yeah, there's actually a couple of stories I want to tell you with
that.
Yes,
please.
There was one woman named Angie Chi, and she lived to be more than 100 years old. And she told this story to the young children as she was growing older, as they lived in Washakie, a community that was established by the church for them years after the massacre. But Angie Chi told of running to the river to escape with a newborn baby. Now you're thinking, and trying to jump into the river, and you're thinking, well, how could they jump into the river? It's below zero. It's freezing. You know, that's not going to do them any good. They're going to die immediately there.
Mm-hmm.
But what you need to understand, if you go up there, there's hot springs all along the edge of that river.
Oh.
So that's why they camped there. It was a naturally warm area. It was as warm a place in Cache Valley as there was. So with those hot springs, they knew where they were at. They knew where they could get a warm bath every day. And she jumped into the river with her baby close to a hot spring and swam under an overhanging bank. Now, once she was there, she found herself with 10 other women in that setting. They could hear the soldiers just above on the bank wondering where she'd gone. And then it happened. Her baby started to cry.
Oh.
And so Angie Chi would often tell the children at Washakie about having to drown her baby, so that those other 10 women might have the opportunity to live and tell about it years later. And that's what happened. So there's stories like that throughout. But the story you referred to is Sagwitch survived. He was shot in the hand, but survived. And after the military had left the camp, he made his way back there. And some of the survivors made their way back. All of the teepees had been burned to the ground, except one, and it was his. All of the food, and you have to remember, they practice this hunter-gatherer lifestyle, but they saved food for the whole year so they wouldn't have to hunt or gather in the winter.
Mm-hmm.
It was used just to relax and spend time with family and play games. And if they'd done their job, they'd had enough food supplies to last all winter. And so the army had scattered the food, set fire to it. They wanted to make sure that any survivors that came back would come back to nothing. Sagwitch came back to the only teepee that was left, and it looked like it was made out of a net. That's how many bullet holes were in it and tears. And so he made his way, walked over, went inside, and he found his wife dead. And next to her was an infant daughter. That infant daughter was just a newborn, and the baby, ironically, was still alive. And so Sagwitch instructed those that were with him to take that little girl, it was a baby daughter, put her in a cradle board and hang her in a nearby tree. Now you'd think, man, that's pretty brutal.
Yeah.
That, you know, you wouldn't try to comfort or console or hold that baby and just make sure she's protected. But he knew that without nourishment from its mother, that baby was going to die. And he had no way of taking care of a newborn daughter. And so that was his instruction to his people. His goal was, he hoped that a settler family from Franklin that was nearby would come to the scene the next day and pick her up and raise her to adulthood. And that's what happened. The next day, a family from Franklin, the whole family, H-U-L-L, whole family from Franklin, Idaho, came by and found her and raised her to adulthood. And I've actually got a picture of her when she's about 30.
Oh, my gosh.
So imagine this. She's in a pioneer dress. Her hair is pulled up in a bun. It's a pioneer. You look at the image and you think that is a pioneer woman from the mid-1800s, and she has a Shoshone face.
Interesting.
But her face, she has a smile on it. And a lot of images back in those days, the natives weren't smiling. You can't find one picture from the 1900s, 19th century, that shows a Native American with a big grin on their face.
Uh-huh.
And so it's just, she looks gentle and she looks different, even though her skin is dark, and you can tell that she's native, but there's been kind of a transformation from what her people would have looked like then. And so she was raised to adulthood. She's actually buried in the Ogden, Utah area out west in a town called Hooper. And she's got a headstone there. She lived to be more than 90. And she was always known in her life as Jane Hull. And so she lived a rich life, school teacher, was very successful. And the Hull family did a wonderful job of taking care of her. Sagwitch knew of her. So
I was just going to ask if there was ever a reconnection, or was she able to be aware of who she was in relation to the Shoshone people?
We don't have any oral history that says that. But I am almost positive, because we have oral history of Sagwitch knowing that she was around and being very proud of her and who she'd become. So I can't imagine that she didn't know the same. Ironically, Sagwitch had a couple of boys that survived. One was 12. His name was Jaeger. And that's the line I come through. Sagwitch was my third great grandfather.
Okay.
So his son Jaeger, who survived, was my great great grandfather. And Jaeger, so I come from that line, but he also had a son that was 3 during the massacre, and his name was Bishop, and that means red clay in okay. Shoshone. But Bishop was a young boy, survived. When Bishop was 6, Sagwitch left him in the care of an uncle in the Cache Valley and had to go to Wellsville. And when he returned, his uncle had sold Bishop to a pioneer family for a sack of flour and a sack of beans and some beef. And so, Sagwitch, I think, was a little perturbed at his brother for doing that. But at the end of the day, come to realize that it was probably a blessing in disguise that Bishop could be adopted into a pioneer family. Bishop goes on to be the first Shoshone school teacher in Cache Valley. He served 3 missions for the LDS Church and lived. He was one of the first in Logan to buy an automobile. And they said Bishop would often race up and down Main Street in Logan on dirt roads with Native Americans in the car, giving them rides. So really a cool history that kind of come out of a really, really tragic event. And so, that's kind of the massacre without getting into some really bad details. But
let's take a break, another break, and coming back in the third block, I want to make sure that we hit a couple things. I want to talk about the conversion of the Shoshone people, or some of them.
Okay.
I also want to talk about plaques and your thought about like memorial plaques and that. I found that fascinating.
Sure.
And I want you to share that with folks. And we'll do our best to get that done in the time we said. We'll come back in the third block of the Cultural Hall.
Imagine running a small business today. It's challenging. Imaging and internet presence is an absolute must. Even with that, you're still a small star in a bright cyber universe. Now, imagine you have someone who understands how to get your site designed for your talents and then easily searched by potential clients. Imagine Lennon Design. Whether it's strictly a website or a whole package of logo creation, advertising media, and promotional materials, Lennon Design is your partner in business. They'll test the boundaries of their imagination to create something unique for you. When you need creative, affordable design, let it be Lennon Design. Call 801-699-3022 or visit LennonDesign.com.
It's time for the third block of the Cultural Hall. Remember, if you like this episode, you can hop online and go to patreon.com/thecultural hall, and you can make a pledge for the show. That money goes to being able to produce the things that we do, be able to share by way of advertising to people so that it becomes a bigger and more spread thing. Patreon.com/thecultural hall. You can make a pledge. And if you do it, you get to be a part of a secret, super secret Facebook group where only those who are Patreon subscribers are able to be. It's patreon.com/thecultural hall. So, Darren, the conversion of the Shoshone people, let's go there.
Let's go to the monuments first, because,
okay,
and then we'll go to the conversion, because the monuments kind of follows what how we remember things, and then I'll tell you about the conversion.
Let's do it.
But in 1932, the good people of Preston and that area in Franklin, Idaho, decided to build a monument. This monument was a celebrated event. Everybody came together to celebrate, you know, we're going to remember what happened. And so that's what happened. Scout groups came together. Once the monument was built, they had a grand unveiling. Political leaders, church leaders from all over came to this. It was a wonderful event. And when they unveiled the monument, it just, what it said on the monument was just troubling. And what I like to say about monuments is, what a monument really accomplishes is that monuments strip us of our obligation to find out for ourselves what actually took place.
Hmm.
And a monument always tells us how it wants the past to be remembered. So think about that.
Yeah.
You know, humans have great memories for what they want to remember. In commemorating the battle, you forget about the uglier parts and you focus on the heroism of the soldiers and the saints. And that's the kind of Daughters of Utah Pioneers monument that exists there today. It's not a story about my people anymore.
Mm-hmm.
It becomes a story about the brave soldiers and the pioneer women who took care of them. So when you construct a monument like that, you firm up memory of those, you know, in the area, and you create history. And so, you know, it talks about attacks by savage Indians in the peaceful inhabitants in that vicinity led to the final battle there. And then it says scores of soldiers were taken to the from the battlefield to the Latter-day Saint community of Franklin, Idaho, where pioneer women trained through trials and necessities of frontier living accepted the responsibility of caring for the wounded until they could be removed to Camp Douglas. So think about that. If you're a traveler going on Highway 91 through Idaho and you stop at that monument, you get to see what they want you to see. They talk about the brave soldiers and the pioneer women who took care of them.
And completely miss your story in its entirety.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's not a story about my people anymore. It becomes a story about them.
Mm-hmm.
And so I tell people it's like a view from a window that has been carefully placed to exclude a whole quadrant of a beautiful landscape. You only see what they want you to see. And so, that's what exists there today. And that's how it's remembered. And that's kind of a problem. And I ask people, is that really what happened? And so, to me, it's not.
Right.
And so the state of Idaho a few years ago bought some land just a quarter mile up the road past that rock monument. And with them, we were able to develop a set of kiosks that actually tell the story that in a fair and balanced way that we want to have told. So you can go there to the Rock Monument. And I always tell people, go there so you can get a perspective. Then go up the hill and go to those kiosks and look at the pictures and hear the history that we're trying to tell. And there's not one person that said, you know, that's kind of slanted your way, too.
Yeah.
It just tells it how it happened. And so it's just, history is about perspective.
Yeah.
And whose perspective.
And it's important. And it's important, I think, that we hear all perspectives.
Absolutely. And that's been my message all along, is everyone has a story worthy of being told, What is your story? Mm-hmm. Because your story is equally as important as my story. And so my story doesn't have any more weight, but it's important that you hear my story. And then, you know, as you have all versions, you can decide for yourself what kind of took place and what happened. So, yeah, that monument's troublesome. And we hold our commemoration there every year on January 29th, just because we don't have anywhere else to go.
Right.
And so, you know, between 300 and 400 attend every year. The governor from Idaho came for the first time ever this year.
Wow.
Our attorney general from Utah comes every year and talks. He's a native Hawaiian and he's awesome. But they come and we have a 1 hour program that just talks about those who perished and song and dance. And then we feed everybody buffalo chili. So
has there been an effort made to either on that site of the original monument from 1932, you said, to add something there or to take that message down?
Well, and here's where I was getting at. The every year after the conclusion of that commemoration, I think the Daughters of Utah Pioneers gets all kinds of hate mail. Mm-hmm. And calls mm-hmm. saying, are you serious? Is that really what you want to tell people when you go through here? And here's the thing. They erected it in 1932, 69 years after the event. So, you know, as far as being 100% accurate, you know, they were telling a story they wanted to have told. But when you look at it today, it's pretty troublesome. And so I've reached out to him a couple of times and just said, hey, there's room on that monument if you wanted to put up a different plaque, another one, not mm-hmm. take down yours, but if you wanted to put a plaque that tells the story more balanced, we'd certainly love to work with you to come up with a narrative that you would be happy with, but reflects history mm-hmm. In a more correct way. And they politely decline, and that's okay. I mean, I'm okay with that. What is really great now is we were able last year to purchase 700 acres of that massacre site.
Oh, wow.
And so now we own all of that site, and I'm raising $5 million now to build a beautiful interpretive center, 400 yards to the west of that DUP monument. And so I'd say in the next couple of years, you'll be able to go there and just hear about a rich history and a culture of a people that survived something tragic and how it's changed our life, how the conversion to Mormonism changed our life and who we are today because of it.
If people wanted to find out more information about that monument you're trying to garner up the funds for, where would they go?
They would go to boaogai.org.
Oh, easy to spell.
Yeah. BOAOGOI.
Okay.
.org.
What does that word mean?
Boaogai means big river.
Oh.
The pioneers changed the Bear River to the Bear River. And before that, the Shoshone always called it Boaogai, which means big river.
I really love the few words that you've shared as you've shared the story, and now I sort of feel bad that I made the joke about it, but it's such a beautiful language.
Sure. And one thing people forget is not only did you take our land, but you changed the names of places that we had called for centuries. So not only do we have no land anymore, but you've also erased us as far as just name places,
right,
and place names. And so that's significant to us. And so we try to get back to just calling it what our people called it forever. And it was always boaogai.org. And that website will take you to the history of the area, what the building, we've actually designed the building, what it's going to look like. And it actually gives an online donation capability if you want to do that.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So,
and we'll make a link with that available at theculturalhall.com in association with this episode. So that's just an easy click through thing for people to be able to do. We have a lot that we have to cover here in the next 10 minutes. Are you good with this?
Conversion.
Let's get conversion, and then I have three questions that I ask everyone that step into the cultural hall. So I'll let you go, and then let me go.
Okay, conversion. So 10 years. So Sedgwick doesn't leave Cache Valley after the massacre. He stays in the Cache Valley because, for the most part, they were his friends. They continued to try to live. They were hired by locals to break horses, work on their farms. They did everything they could to live. And in May of 1873, 10 years after the massacre, Sagwitch and his people, there were about 150 of them, camped over by Brigham City on the other side of the mountain. Sagwitch has a dream. And in his dream, three men appear to him in his dream that tell him the existence of a God among the Mormon people. They told him that this God was a true God, and that he could send for missionaries that would tell him and his people what they needed to do and how they needed to change their life. And so the next day, Sagwitch knew of a man that lived in Ogden that had been a missionary to the Shoshones in 1855 in central Idaho. Hmm. This man spoke fluent Shoshone. So Sagwitch makes his way to George Washington Hill's home in Ogden and says, "The Great Spirit has made it known to me that we need to learn about your church." And George Washington Hill told him, "I'm no longer a missionary. There's order in the Lord's church. You're going to have to go to Salt Lake and make that request." Well, Sagwitch came the next 2 days making the same request. And then 2 days after that, George Washington Hill received correspondence from Brigham Young saying, "Come to my office." And he went down, and Brigham Young said, "George, I've had a heavy burden on my shoulders, and that burden is now going to become yours." And so George was called to be a missionary to Sagwitch and his people from that day forth. George goes home, tells his wife and six children, and he had a farm, and he was also a night watchman at the Union Pacific in Ogden. The railroad had come through now. It's 1873. And George's life was about to change. So he goes to work one night, and he's a night watchman. His only job was to guard the train when it was in Ogden that had come from Evanston, Wyoming. Mm-hmm. He gets to work, and he's told that the train got derailed and there won't be a train that night. So not wanting to waste the opportunity, he thought, well, good a time as any to go find Sagwitch and his band. And so he jumps on a freighter train that was leaving Ogden that went to Corinne. Corinne was a Wild West town. It was a railroad town out in Box Elder County. The Shoshones were about 10 miles north of Corinne. He gets there. It's still dark. He waits till it's light. He wakes up, he sleeps a little bit, wakes up the next morning, gets pointed in the direction of their camp, and heads out on foot. And about halfway, he encounters a Shoshone on a horse riding the other way. And he said to George Washington Hill and Shoshone, "Our chief is sending us to town to get some food." And so a little further down the path, he sees a man walking on a horse with another horse, and it was Sagwitch. And he sees George Washington Hill, and they meet. And Sagwitch said, "I brought you a horse for the rest of your way. I knew you'd be tired." And I'm sure the conversation, and this is from George Washington Hill's journal. He said, "I told Sagwitch, hey, my wife doesn't even know I'm here. You know, I didn't tell anybody I was coming. I told you I would come, but it'd be sometime later." And Sagwitch then said, "I had a dream last night, and the Great Spirit told me you were coming this morning."
Wow.
And so George made his way back, and in his journal, he describes as having the best feast a man had ever had. And he then proceeded to teach Sagwitch the gospel of Jesus Christ in his way. And the next day, Sagwitch and 101 other Shoshones were baptized in the Bear River. The same Bear River where Sagwitch watched the entire destruction of his people 10 years previous to that. So
symbolic and meaningful and...
Oh, absolutely.
Oh, my gosh.
What people don't know is a year later, the other Shoshones had heard how good the Mormons had been to Sagwitch. And that next year, more than 4,000 Shoshone descended upon Box Elder County.
Wow.
Among them, Chief Washakie, of the Eastern Band, and they were all converted. They were all baptized Mormons.
Wow.
And so probably to go back to their wherever they were from, never to hear about the church again.
Mm-hmm.
But at least, you know, they were baptized. And so that began a long line of that's why I'm a sixth generation Shoshone LDS Latter-day Saint. Yeah. Zagwitz joined the church in 1873. And, you know, he's my third great grandfather.
Yeah.
From that time on, we've been faithful Latter-day Saints. And so, yeah, cool story.
Yes, absolutely. You know, a lot of people will hear the story of the poor treatment of Native Americans and get really angry. Some will take on that guilt for themselves. You know, how could, you know, the church or my people or whatever.
Sure,
What do you hope that we take away from learning this history?
The big thing for me is I tell people, you know, the massacre has taught me many lessons over the years. And one of them is that bad things happen to people.
Right.
And they're going to happen to me and you all the time. But how we deal with that and how we process that will determine our character and determine who we're going to become mm-hmm. down the road. It's taught me that it's important to offer unconditional forgiveness to everyone, but it doesn't mean we need to forget. And so those couple of things, you know, has helped me navigate those terrible things that happened to our people.
Yeah.
Absolutely, they were horrific.
Yeah.
But I can't live there. I got to live for my people today and say, who are we today? How can I take that tragic event and make us a better people and learn from it and help others learn from it? And so that's been my goal.
Aside from having you maybe come and speak at a fireside or obviously listening to this episode, where else can people get more information about the Shoshone people?
Scott Christensen, he's an archivist with the LDS Church. He did his doctorate work and he wrote a book, his dissertation. It's called Sagwitch, Shoshone Chieftain, Mormon Elder. I think it's found on Amazon. And it's very good. It details all of the interaction between the saints and Sagwitch and his people
okay.
in more of a historical researched context.
Mm-hmm.
So Scott, you know, dug up every correspondence that was made. The wonderful thing about Mormons, they write everything down.
Yeah.
So you can find it.
Yeah.
I have a book coming out in about 2 months. We're working on the cover and the title right now. I thought it was going to be stories my grandmother told me.
Uh-huh.
It might be Bear River Massacre, a Shoshone perspective. Stay tuned on the title, but it'll be out on Amazon and other places, hopefully within a couple of months.
Well, and I hope that you'll reach back out and I can share that with people who listen to this.
Absolutely. I would love to. That would be helpful for me as well. So thank you.
You bet. We come to this point of the interview where I ask you three questions that we ask everyone who steps into the cultural hall. So I'll ask those of you now. The first question is, do you have a calling currently and what is it?
I do. I'm the gospel doctrine teacher in the far west stake in Utah.
Okay.
And I love it.
If you could pick a calling for yourself, either one that exists or make one up, what would you pick?
It would be the gospel doctrine teacher.
Oh, you're living your dream, huh?
Well, that's all I've ever done. Well, that's not true. I was the ward mission leader prior to this. So I love sharing the gospel. I love giving people maybe a different perspective because
mm-hmm.
I think a little bit differently. I'm more out looking for the marginalized and you know, the woman caught in adultery. Stories that you can take down another path and open people's eyes up to really, you know, we share the gospel of Jesus Christ, but I want them to look at it from another point of view
yeah.
and how they maybe help others. And sometimes in Mormonism, we have a tendency to get caught up in our own deal and Mormon speak, I like to say,
right.
As opposed to just pure gospel of Christ.
Right.
And so it's important for me that I can share, you know, some of my thoughts and feelings that way. So
the final question we ask everyone is, what is your favorite part of your faith?
Oh, being able to serve. And I think it spills over into my tribal family.
Mm-hmm.
I 2 days ago, I went to the last elementary school for this year to share my culture. I take artifacts. I talk about the Shoshone culture. And I went to 70 this year.
Oh, my gosh.
70 elementaries throughout the year. They don't pay me. I don't get paid to do that. I do it because I want to share that rich culture with people and enrich their life in some way. And so service, being able to just live a life of different than, you know, your own, and sharing a message that many people really need to hear. So that's my goal.
Well, Darren, thank you so much for being with us. We hope that this episode has nourished and strengthened your body, that if you are not healthy enough to listen this week, that you'll be healthy enough to listen next week, and that when the time comes, you'll be able to travel home in safety. In the meantime, we'll be saving a seat for you on the back row of the Cultural Hall.
Save me a seat. It's sure to be neat on the back row. We really gotta go on the Cultural Hall show.